Hello, I'm Martin Kessler, and today I'm joined by returning guest Spencer Seams. Hi, Spencer.
Oh, hello.
Thank you for joining me and for suggesting this film to discuss, David and Lisa, which it's a film I like, but I find it doesn't come up in conversations as much as maybe it should, or maybe I would hope. So I'm glad to have this opportunity to discuss it with you. Thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah, I just wanted an excuse to watch this again, because I think this is the third time I've seen it, and every time I always think, oh, this is great, but then I realize, oh, it's not that great, but at the same time, it's still very, I just find it very sweet and heartwarming and very interesting American film from this era.
Right. I think, yeah, in some ways it's a little bit rough around the edges. It's the Frank and Eleanor Perry's first film. Like, you can kind of tell it's a first-time filmmaker and that it's got a very low budget, but I find that they make great use of everything that they have available to them. You know, the performances are really effective, the writing's really great. Like, I find it really shines in that way. It's smart, but there's a lot of emotion there. And I should say the basic story. It's a following a character named David, who is going to a school for the mentally ill. And he meets a girl, Lisa, there, and it's sort of about their relationship, friendship, you know, even a little bit romance at a certain point. And he gets pulled out of the school for talking back to his mother and decides to go back, basically, of his own accord. He's a little bit chilly at first, but he warms up to the other students at the school and makes friends, basically, with the psychiatrist Dr. Swinford.
This is a stupid side note, but the name Swinford always makes me think of elementary school, because there's a kid with the last name Swinford I knew growing up, and it's just, and that's like a, it sounds so stupid that it's made up, so every time I hear it, it's like, yeah, it always takes me back to like being in second grade.
I don't think I've ever met somebody named Swinford. I was curious, that character in particular, if it's sort of based on Theodore Isaac Rubin, who wrote the novel that the film is based on. Like, he's a real psychologist. I think he's still alive, actually. He's in his 90s. But I was kind of guessing if maybe that character is sort of the novelist surrogate. You know, he's the kind of wise psychiatrist who doesn't use too much jargon, and he's mostly there to listen, and he's kind of encouraging but doesn't push it. Like, that seems like there's some experience of a real psychiatrist in the film. It's coming through in that character, how he, you know, he has a very sensitive approach to dealing with these young people.
I don't really know much about the source material, but so I can't really speak to that per se, but I do like that character. He was like basically the only real parent figure that David had, because his mom, you immediately get the sense of she doesn't like being a mother, and she kind of sees David as in the way. And Swinford is the first adult to really actually seem to care about him.
And the parents, they're not quite antagonists. Like, they're not really treated like bad people, but you can kind of get why they might have had a role in the way David is. Like, they don't like to really acknowledge that there's a problem, it seems like. His mother especially, you know, there's a few points when, you know, she's like, oh, you're not crazy, you just have an issue. And David's like, yeah, I'm actually crazy. He's trying to tell her, you know, she doesn't really want to acknowledge how serious it is. And like, his father, you know, he's not such a bad guy. Like, there's that one scene when he comes to David's bedroom after the dinner scene, and he's saying, if it's something I did, I'm sorry. Like he's just trying to connect with his son and doesn't really understand how or have any idea how. Later on, when David's talking to Dr. Swinford, he says, you know, my father's a success. He has a lot of money, but he's not a success inside. And you kind of get the impression that the father's like maybe a weak man in certain ways, so like he's not as strong.
And on the dinner scene before that, the mom is just chewing him out and like talking about like she wants her son to go to college, and he says, well, I went to college too. And she says, like, well, no one's heard of your college. And it's
Right.
just you. And that dinner scene encapsulates their pretty horrible marriage, and some of the details I got a little confused. So, I think she was saying that she came from a poor family and his family had money, or was it the other way around?
I think that's what she was saying, but the way she phrases it, it also seems like maybe the husband's family didn't value these things. She seems to really care what school the son goes to and what people think. Like, the father doesn't seem as hung up on appearances and presentation as she is.
Yeah, like he just doesn't get his son. And I think part of it is his vague job that it's never really clear what he does. You just know he goes on business trips a lot.
He's a businessman.
Yeah,
Yeah.
he's just like the classic sitcom like of that era, like dad goes to the office and goes to Chicago sometimes.
He's got a bow tie and everything. Yeah. But like that one scene, the dinner table scene, that shot, I always think like maybe that's the most amazing shot in the film when it starts as a close up on David's face, Keir Dalle's face, and it's just zooming out and it feels like the walls are kind of like pushing in on him and you feel that anxiety that he has, that seems pretty key to his mental illness. We should maybe
Oh
describe
yeah. Mental illness.
what it
Yeah,
is.
mental illness plays a huge role in this film. Part of why I like it is that I feel portrays mental illness in a not necessarily realistic way, but in a accurate way compared to stuff now.
Even today,
Yeah.
I find a lot of films, like I think a lot of screenwriters, they sort of look at the diagnosis of, oh, like this is what that mental illness is, and apply that to a character and create a character out of that. This almost feels like the characters are created independently, and then the definition of what this mental illness is applied after. Like, when David's sort of analyzing Lisa, and he said, well, like I think she's, schizophrenic, or like it feels more like they're struggling to come up with a definition for what these illnesses are, not so much like, oh, they've got split personality. And, like a lot of movies seem to have that approach to mental illness where it's like the whole character is just the illness,
Yeah.
it's all based around that. Instead, this sort of treats it as a part of the character and
Yeah,
then,
I'm right now going through the Don Ritchie Ozu book, and Ozu, his approach, him and Kogo Noda, his screenwriter that he worked with his whole career, they would craft the characters first and then to come up with the story. And I get a sense of the Perrys. They did all the character stuff to try and nail that down, and then they tried to apply the mental illness to the characters. Because, like, it's like you were saying, they aren't. It's but personality, it's like they are also people too, and they have distinct personalities. And like even like the side characters who we barely see, like Carlos, who.
Yeah, you get a sense of like Carlos, he's acting very sexual, and there's that one scene where he hits on David's mother.
Yeah.
He's, oh, you're a sexy mom, and this movie's made 1962, so like just the way he's talking to her feels like really I can imagine people at that time being especially shocked. But then David comes in and he's like, yeah, I think he's got delusions of grandeur. Like, it's not that he's
Yeah.
like he was bragging about, oh, I'm in here because I got all these girls pregnant, but like it's probably not true. It's him overcompensating and being boastful. Like even a character like that who's relatively small, you get a sense that it's a three-dimensional character. Or just even when they're introducing all these other students, there's the one girl, I think Josette, she doesn't say hi, like she's very quiet, and you just get an impression, very quickly of who these people are. But it feels like there's
Yeah, there's that kid with glasses, Simon,
Simon, yeah.
who for some reason he reminds me of Woody Allen, like a young Woody Allen, if he is more
Right.
neurotic.
Yeah, he's very neurotic. Or you have that
Yeah.
one girl, Kate, like she's very she's sort of like flirtatious and boastful, and she seems pretty normal to me. Like I was wondering too if there's that thing where people considered certain behavior a sign of mental illness in the 60s that they wouldn't necessarily today. Like, if a woman was just like a little bit too independent, they were like, "Oh, you clearly have a
Oh
problem." Like, I was wondering if there's some of
yeah,
that
I got
in
that
that
from
character.
her. Like she, also she kind of looks notably older compared to the other students.
Right.
Like Kier, he looked baby
Oh,
face
Keir Delay.
delay. He looked baby face for quite a while.
Like I was I maybe not too surprised, but like he was 26 when he played in the film, I
Yeah.
think. 26, 27, like around that age. I think he said when he auditioned for the Perrys, he had known them already, but he went and got a haircut to make himself look younger. And he came in, they were like, "Oh, Keir, like if only you were 5 years younger." And they look at it, "Oh, I guess you do look 5 years younger. You got the part." But I mean, that's pretty common. Casting people are a little bit older, but he plays somebody who's, maybe 18 years old, like around that age, very well.
Yeah, because they talk about college, so presumably it's end of high school for him.
Right.
And he kind of looks like Anthony Perkins a bit.
Yeah,
Like
a little like.
I get the similar type of vibe of you've probably seen Bonnie Lake is Missing.
Yes. It's funny just comparing him to Anthony Perkins in Psycho, which came just 2 years earlier. And like, I don't know, Psycho, it's a great, great classic film, but I always kind of hated the ending when they have the psychiatrist come out and explain everything. And like that scene, it's so awful, but
That
like
would have been my favorite Hitchcock movie if it weren't for
right.
that terrible, terrible ending.
I feel the same way. The ending kind of, it doesn't ruin the film, but like it sure takes it down a notch. And I almost like David and Lisa more for things that the film doesn't do than certain things that it does. Like it's very restrained, it's very naturalistic. It doesn't try to artificially create too much drama. The only thing I thought was a tiny bit contrived. It's like, "Oh, we need a climax. Lisa runs away." Okay, like Lisa's missing, she's lost in the city. Like we need some kind of a climax because it's so character based up to that point. It's just you
Yeah.
need like a little bit of drama to kind of push it to that final moment, that final scene, but like that's pretty tiny. Like everything else feels very organic, like the story coming out of these
Yeah,
characters'
I mean,
behavior and
yeah.
interactions.
For me, like the only like, some of the problems, which are kind of fairly minor, would be like some of the editing at times is kind of jarring. But I don't think it's meant to be jarring. It's kind of like, now, that's just kind of a weird edit. I'm not sure why it's here.
Right, I wonder how much of that's just a product of the budget and like, "Oh, those are the two shots we have. We don't necessarily have great coverage," because like a lot of the film's shot in wide shot. A lot of it feels kind of like we had to kind of get this in, one shot. We couldn't necessarily get close-ups and get everything that we needed. So I guess that some of it's cobbled together. I know Keir Delay pointed out in the very final scene when the car pulls up. And David gets out. You see the exhaust in the car going one way, and then it cuts like in the same shot, and the exhaust is going the other way. I guess because they had to like put together two shots of the car pulling up and him getting out, But so, like, I think there's things like that because the budget was only, I forget, like, it was like, right around $100,000 or $120,000, I think. It was a pretty tiny film, so it ended up being a big success and nominated for Oscars. And Frank and Eleanor Perry, they kind of built their career off of this film, and it's kind of a weird career. I think they split up, and then Frank Perry went off and made like,
Then his career wasn't great compared to.
his career wasn't great. Like I won't say they're all bad films, but it feels like his career, like around the Mommy Dearest age, wasn't in the best place.
But he didn't have
But
much control of that movie either. He just kind of had to do what he was told. And that was the end of his career for the most part. It's kind of like he had all this status and stature from his independent days of like dating Lisa and the swimmer. And then it kind of turned into, oh, your wife is gone, and so you don't have a writer like to
You don't have this great
yeah.
writer to work with. So, I think after they split up, mostly his career, I think, kind of suffered from that because, she was still working as a writer. I think she wrote a couple
She had a couple things
films.
produced, and then she died in, I think, mid
She
'80s.
had cancer, so she died pretty young, I think. But like Swimmer, that was another one where I think they had control while they were shooting it, basically, and then it kind of got taken away in the editing. And famously, Sidney Pollack came in and reshot a big chunk of the film. And I think that's like a really, really great film. That's maybe one of my favorite films, The Swimmer, but it's sort of a messy production history. And not to take away too much credit from the Perrys, because I think like they made huge contributions to that, but that's one of the rare instances where I think that's a film that's probably better off for having been messed with, by the producers.
I haven't seen that yet. It's been on my Netflix DVD list for, I want to say, at least 3 years. I keep moving it back.
Okay, it's great. I know it's kind of like, what is this? It's like Burt Lancaster in a swimsuit on the cover, but it's really great, actually. I think that's a fantastic film.
Put it on my list for a reason, and I just keep pushing
Right.
it back, and I don't know
I
why.
mean, not to like spoil it or anything, but like there is definitely overlap with some of the themes in David and Lisa, and you can even, depending how you interpret The Swimmer, you could say that's a film about mental illness as well. So, like, there's a few through lines, and it also has that very strong focus on character.
Like, for me, the only character that kind of borders on not the best is Carlos, because a little bit just feels like the Latin lover stereotype, but at the same time, he kind of has like a real genuine personality, so I'm not, so it kind of feels like a bit like they're commenting on that to an extent.
Well, because you find out he's basically putting on an act to like overcompensate. Like, that's sort of where that persona comes from. He's like adopting a certain behavior to try to make up for his own, maybe insecurities, or like just that moment when David says, "Oh, he has delusions of grandeur." Like, it kind of puts it into perspective enough. It's like just enough of a touch to feel like the character's not a cliche, Or I mean, the other character that I think is like maybe a little bit on the weaker side is the other psychiatrist, not Dr. Swinford.
John.
John, he's a little like, "Oh, I just don't get it," trying to help Lisa, but like he mostly seems like a good guy who's just a little bit impatient, not necessarily like a bad character. It's just
Yeah, played by Clifton James, famously in Live and Let Die as the sheriff with the terrible,
right.
terrible Southern accent.
Yeah, there's no terrible accent here,
No, he's
but
restrained. There's no
yeah.
secret agent on whose side. None of that. He's talking with like a normal voice, and he's quiet. And
Right.
for me, it was like, oh, he can actually act. It took like over an hour for me to notice it was him.
Yeah. I mean, all the performances, I think, are pretty impressive. The major performances, like Jennet Margolin as Lisa, the character speaks in rhymes half the time, and the other half of the time she's sort of thinking of herself as a different person and writing, not talking. So it's like she has this difficulty communicating, and it's only at the end, after she can kind of reconcile these two identities of herself, that she can, sort of communicate normally with David. But like, that's, there's a sweetness about the character, and there's like a freedom to her. Like, even as you see her struggling to communicate and being frustrated with the way people communicate, like I like a lot of the contrast between David and Lisa. Like, she's painting on the walls, you see, like she's painting everywhere, and then David's doing these very technical looking drawings. He's very focused, and
He's basically it's like a he's a snob and she's a slob.
a bit of that,
Yeah,
yeah.
like
It's
she's
the
very free spirited. She is more artistic. She is less articulate or doesn't or
Yes.
like because the Lisa personality speaks in rhyme. The Muriel personality is this. I guess she's mute because I don't think. Well, at the end, they kind of she has a moment of clarity and they merge. But before that, the Muriel part of her never speaks and just writes on that giant like legal pad or whatever she had.
And David, I mean, one of his major triggers is being touched. Like, you find out that he has this huge anxiety about death, and like he associates being touched with like a big threat, that you can die from being touched. You can, he sort of freaks out whenever somebody touches him or tries to touch him, because in his mind that could lead to him dying, and he's very, worried about, worried about the inevitability of death. Like that's kind of, ultimately what you find out is central to his mental illness. That's a major part of it. You're not, it's only sort of implied why that snowballed to that point, but you definitely sort of get a sense of what the core of his anxieties are. And you have those great dream sequences with the heads in the clock, that's kind of got the axe heads at the tip of the clock hands that he's moving around, chopping people's heads off in his dream.
Yeah,
And
and that was I first saw this on Fandor a few years ago, and it just had the image of him moving the clock hand, and I thought this would be like a trippy, surreal, like Buñuel movie, and then when I watched it, I was very pleasantly surprised. It's like, oh, it's still really good, just it wasn't the super surreal, like Buñuel thing I was hoping it was, because using that tag image, the thumbnail of the dream sequence, is a bit misleading.
You just think the whole film's going to be like that, and really it's just the dream sequences. But I always think of Bergman when I watch this film. Like, you have those dream sequences in Wild
Oh
Strawberries,
yeah, I
and
was gonna bring up
the
that one too.
right, and like the poster looks, or the image of David with Lisa's head sideways, it's like exactly the same as the image in Persona, even though this came a couple of years earlier. And I'm like, oh, that's a little suspicious. Maybe there's a connection there, I don't
Don't know.
know. But
Bergman
like, there's
probably saw this and was like, "Hey, I can use that."
I mean, this was pretty widely seen. I think they said it was even more popular in Europe than it was in the States, maybe. It had a wide release, and it brought a lot of attention to them.
Well, Janet didn't have much of a career. She had like towards the end, it kind of wasn't much. Like compared to Keir, she didn't have that huge of a career.
No, like I think she died in 1993, quite young, I
Yeah,
think.
she is, I think, in her 40s.
Yeah, like that's pretty young. And like Keir DeLay, he still shows up and stuff. He's not like a big star, but like he's in the
She's on the path that not Netflix, Hulu show.
Okay.
I think that's the most recent. In like other stuff, and her big thing towards the end of her career was Ghostbusters 2.
Well, I know she was in Annie Hall, and I don't know, she's in a couple of like 60s, 70s films. I haven't seen them all, but I don't know how she ended up in those like bit parts towards the end. That's sort of too bad. She was in television. I know like Keir DeLay, he also had kind of like a rough time for a while in the 70s, 80s, because he was in all these like Connexploitation movies for a while. Like, he was kind of a big star towards the end of the 60s. And then like he's in, like, I love Black Christmas, but like,
Wait,
it's this weird little Canadian.
oh, I
Yeah.
forgot he was in
And I
that.
think he plays like a teenager in that too, right? Like he's still playing the like 19-year-old, I think. I haven't seen it for a little while, but he's got the longer hair in it. And
Oh yeah, okay, that's clicking. I didn't realize that was him.
yeah, he's in Paperback Hero. He's in like a couple of these Canadian films where I don't know if, it's like,
Is he one of yours?
I don't think so. I checked before, and I think he was like from
Oh,
Ohio or
because with a
something,
name
but
like that,
like
it's either like French Canadian or like vaguely European, like Audrey Hepburn.
he's got like a nondescript enough accent, he could be. I think he's in the Audrey Hepburn, like the TV movie, which I don't know, that's funny. But
But on the note of TV movie, this was remade as a TV movie in 98.
that makes sense, because like if you're gonna do a TV movie, it makes sense to get something that could be done on a budget. Like I know there's also there was like a theater production of David and Lisa, which it doesn't take that much effort to look at this film and stage it as a play, because most of it's one location. There's the scenes at David's home, and then there's the scenes at the art gallery, but it's almost all at the school.
And do you know who played the three central parts in the TV movie without looking it up?
No, I don't
It
know.
was Sidney Poitier as the doctor. And Brittany
Okay.
Murphy as Lisa, which is great casting, I think.
That's
Brittany
great
Murphy
casting, yeah.
was way underrated. And Lucas Haas as David,
Okay.
which
All right.
I guess I haven't seen much young Lucas Haas stuff. I only know him from like Brick and Onward,
Yeah.
so I don't know if he was good as a child actor.
That's a pretty good guess. Maybe it's good,
I
actually.
don't
I
know.
might have to check it out after. I couldn't find it online after like just a cursory search, so I don't know if it's like on VHS tape or what, but I don't know. That might be okay actually, because I think you could update this story fairly easily. Like some of the vernacular might be changed, but like the basic emotions I think are still, there's like a little bit of a timeless quality to this film, I find.
It doesn't, like, I don't think there's any music in it besides Carlos singing like a Latin love song in a couple scenes, and
Maybe just at the beginning and the end,
yeah.
there's that.
I
That's
mean,
about it.
and
Like,
there's like their score obviously, but there's no like, oh, here's a Beatles song, or they're talking about 62, so they're just talking about Kennedy. There's so it's very smart and keep it timeless and vaguely 20th century.
Well, like even the psychological references, it feels smart in that it doesn't get too hung up on a lot of these classifications, which do change over time, and eventually things do fall out of date. Like, feel a little bit stupid if a doctor comes in and says, "Oh, she's got hysteria" or something like that. Like I know that was already out of date by 1960s, but you know what I mean. Like sometimes you hear the way people talk about mental illness in older films, and it sounds so out of date, I guess is probably the best way to describe it. It feels,
Hits like a thud a little
ugh.
bit. It's like, oh, that part doesn't age too well.
I know, like the way it treats the characters too. Like, there's so much empathy towards them, sympathy, empathy. Like, it doesn't feel like, it doesn't even feel that hung up on the mental illness. Like the romance side of the story, it feels like just any two teens kind of connecting and being friends and developing an emotional connection. Like, that's
Yeah, like
almost.
immediately, I marked at 9 minutes in, when David goes through the front door, you see Lisa just like kind of just
Watching
watching
him, yeah.
him, and immediately there's that connection of, like there's kind of an interest between them, and remember the first few times we see Lisa, he's always in the room just reading a book, but it's from perspective of him, so it's from perspective. Perspective of him, where it's like, oh, he's not directly reading a book. He's just trying to hang out, be around the girl he had a crush on.
Exactly. Yeah, so it's teens with crushes, or even it's sort of funny when like David's first arriving at the school, and you have like the gossip amongst the other students, like, oh, like there's new boy here. I hear he's handsome. Like, they're already, it's like the new kid transferring into high school. Like, it's that kind of a conversation. And the film, goes as far as to actually reflect back on the way mentally ill people were treated. And like, there's that one guy with his family who shoves Lisa, he calls her nuts, and David says like, oh well, if you're normal, who wants to be normal? And they end up chanting like a bunch of screwballs spoiling the town at this guy who just had no patience with her. And like that seems like a big thing. Like, you see, even today you see some people like interacting with somebody who maybe has mental illness or has some kind of an issue, and that they're not patient at all. Like, I don't know. I think you should be,
I mean,
but.
I see that sometimes at my job because we have volunteers come in who are from KSI, which I don't know if that's a thing outside US, but it's a thing. It's a service to give mentally handicapped people like
Okay.
volunteer jobs or like real jobs, depending on like how severe the condition is. And some of my coworkers can be a little impatient with the KSI people, and it's and I mean most of them are not. Most of them are like, we treat them like people and they want to help out. But sometimes it's kind
Yeah.
of like, give them a break. Give them a break with like mopping up the floor. It's but whatever.
Yeah, no. I mean, you know, it wasn't even that long ago. Like, a lot of people sort of had this attitude that somebody who's, you know, maybe noticeably mentally ill shouldn't even be out in public. Or, like, I think, you know, of course, there's still, obviously, you know, there's always room for improvement, but it seems like things have changed a lot since David and Lisa was made. So it's nice to see that the attitudes in the film still hold up. It doesn't feel. Like, it doesn't feel rooted in a perspective that you're like, oh, well, it's a time capsule, or oh, you have to really, like, just excuse certain things of the time period the way you do with other, you know, maybe similar films or films from around that time period.
It because it's independent, that really helps it not age poorly, because like there's actually the time and care of Eleanor and Frank Perry making them actual people and not just a walking illness, and it's very refreshing. And like what's that, like the most recent movie of mental illness that I can think of that like really got under my skin was Silver Linings Playbook, where it's
Oh,
treated way too cutesy, and
yeah.
it's kind of like Dave and Lisa did this like 50 years ago, and yet this movie does it so poorly.
The performances too, I thought, maybe also because it's an independent film, it doesn't feel too rooted in that like Hollywood style acting that was still kind of around in the 60s. Like, you know, it's right around the time method acting was catching on. Like, it feels a little bit ahead of its time. Some of the performances, like they also hold up pretty well, I think.
Like even Lisa, who when she's doing her rhyming thing, it can seem a little silly and goofy. Like describing it sounds silly and goofy, but when you actually watch it, it's like, oh no, like this is like rooted and natural, and it feels very human, as opposed to like if this was like a big Hollywood production, it would have been a bit more over the top too. Get the message across,
Yeah.
where it's like you can just get the message across a different way. Like the only other like movie from around this time that kind of gets mental illness right, also I think, is Texas Chainsaw, because Gunnar Hansen
Okay.
spent time in a what was it, like a hospital for mentally ill, and he observed their behavior for a couple days, and that's what he based his Leatherface performance off of. Which, if you've seen the movie, it's very clear that Leatherface is developmentally disabled, you know, and like there's actual thought and care put into like getting those aspects correct.
That's true. I mean, that's about a decade later, so it takes a while. And of course, that's a horror film, so it's going for something a little bit different. But I like what Tobe Hooper said about, well, like, depending on your perspective, like it's Leatherface, the worst day in his life, because like these people just keep showing up and he has to keep killing them. Like he said, like depending on how you look at it, it's a completely different film. But yeah, like it's difficult because. I think some actors do take on these roles. Like, it was sort of famously lampooned in Tropic Thunder, you know, like this idea of actors taking on these roles basically just to show off their acting prowess. And it can feel sort of, I don't know, cynical sometimes when you see certain actors take on these roles. And maybe it's because of the low budget and because everything feels very grounded. Like, it doesn't feel like there's anything cynical or show-offy here. That's one thing I like quite a bit about the film.
Some of these shots at certain points, specifically when I forgot what David does, but he does something that irritates Lisa and she threatens to touch him. And it's like this shot
Right.
focused on her face as she's moving, and it's focused on his face as he's backing away. And the type of shot is what Spike Lee does tends to do, and
Yeah.
Melvin Van Peebles does that a lot too in
Yeah,
early
in
work.
Story of a Three-Day Pass. Yeah. I was trying to figure out like if that style comes from like German Expressionism. Like I always think there's it's not quite the same shot, but there's something similar in The Last Laugh with like the cameras on the actor's face and it's sort of spinning around as the background changes or you know moving with the actor's face. Like if it's part of that the idea of the cinema unchained, you know, but. there is like maybe some expressionist influence in the film, you know, with those dream sequences that like we're talking about. And you know, the shot, I think, of towards the very end when Lee says at the art gallery, where she runs to because she gets lost, and there's like a really high angle shot, I think, and she looks really small, and it's like, oh yeah, she's small. Like, that's a very expressive shot. So even though, like, I think a lot of the film is very matter of fact the way it's shot, there are these like little expressionist touches here and there, which makes sense for a film that's so internal. You know, it's a psychological film. There's like the shot of the father when he's over David's bed, and the way it's lit, like it looks like an expressionist kind of shot. Or like even you know, some of the images, like at the art gallery when Lisa climbs on the sculpture, you know, and it's this image of this woman holding a child, and the way she kind of clings to this statue, like this image tells its own sort of story without really elaborating on it or explaining why she reacts the way she does to this one statue.
Yeah, like at that moment, that's another part where you see how the outside world besides that school reacts to people, because then, like, there's that little girl who points it out, and the curator, he's kind of causing a huge scene, and then luckily one of the teachers is like, hey, it's okay, we can take care of this. And it's another reminder of like, oh, that it's still like outside of their world. It's not that's not safe, but it's kind of depressing how just no one else kind of understands how to act around them or to treat them like people.
Right. I mean, David, when he first gets sent to the school, he's a little bit upset. Like, he doesn't want to be there. He doesn't, like, you know, it sounds like, oh, this is terrible being sent off to this school for mentally ill people. And then, you know, by the midpoint of the film, he wants to go back. Like, that's the place where he feels most at home, actually, is with these other people, his peers. You know, like, it's actually a welcoming place, and the staff are very supportive, and it's a healthy place to be, actually. I mean, even to the point where, like, David, he's developing this interest in the psychiatry. There's that one scene with Dr. Swinford a little bit towards the end when he's saying, you know, I was thinking of maybe getting into the medical field. Do you think I could be a psychiatrist? And Swinford says, yes. Like, you know, that's in a roundabout kind of way. It feels like a big compliment from David to Swinford after they've had, like, all these little... After mostly it's David with these verbal barbs at him, but like, you know, that's his way of saying, like, I respect what you do, and I wish I could do that, you know, for people, help people the way you're helping me. Like, he clearly sees value in this profession. So like, it's very complimentary. I find that line, if, you know, I'd like to be a psychiatrist.
Initially, I thought that whole aspect was David just trying to be like a smart-ass teenager and be like, well, oh, your job's not so tough, and like, he's just observing people and like keeping track of their, like, the symptoms and signs of their own mental illness. But then
he comes across that way at first. Yeah,
you know, like, he's very, like, he starts out very terrible, but not because of illness, just because he's like a really moody teen, and like, it kind of turned more into like, oh, he's this kind of... But then you learn why he is the way he is, like, when he goes back home. But, like, I just love that transformation from him being this pretty irritating person to be around to, like, this very lovable kid. He was 20. He was almost my age when he was filming this.
I mean, he seems younger in the film, the way he's playing it. But, like, I know what you mean. Like, it's very delicately handled, that transformation. It's not like a... It's not immediate, you know, it's gradually him kind of opening up, and him, you know, like, when the doctor kind of keeps offering, like, you know, hey, we can talk, and he's saying, like, no, I'm going for a walk, and eventually the doctor said, well, I'll come with you for a walk, and it's that slow development, you know, it sort of acknowledges that these things don't improve overnight, you know, like, I think a lot of films... The idea that by the end, these characters have this sort of bigger breakthrough could come across really phony and forced. But I feel like because the film puts the work in at the end, you can believe that they would both have a breakthrough, partly, you know, through each other's support. Like, it's not easy for him to reach out his hand and have her touch it at the end, but you know, you get a sense that like that's a big step that they both took in that final scene. So like it feels like, you know, not like the film's saying, oh, they're cured, happy ending, but you know, they're sort of in a better place because of each other and because of, you know, the school and all that.
It's like on my podcast, High and Low Curse Hall podcast, we did one Wonderful Sunday, which is about, which also kind of about mental illness a little bit actually. And it's this one Sunday in this couple's life that kind of doesn't go too well, hence the title, One Wonderful Sunday. And it ends on a note of them, their problems are not fixed, but there's a breakthrough of how to deal with their problems. And I feel like that's like a thing that you won't really see in a lot of mainstream American stuff at this point in time, where it would end on like, here's the first step of, you know, them curing themselves. It's like, well, no, it takes time. You have to work towards it. And with Lisa, she slowly transforms from, I don't want to say a blank slate, but she is kind of this, like her.
Well, I feel like her big hurdle is being able to communicate. Like that seems like the thing that she's kind of hung up on is being able to express herself.
But then there's also the whole thing of that David obviously likes her in a romantic way, and he calls her a girl, and no one, and like him calling her a girl almost like makes her
pearl of a girl.
Yeah. It makes her like come to realize, oh, she is like a girl. She does have romantic feelings. And there's a part where she's like just like touching herself. No, Jesus Christ.
Well, not like, I mean, even that like feels pretty explicit for a 1960s movie, but it's not that explicit actually. Yeah.
Not.
It's just enough to imply. Yeah. Well, like it's enough to imply that she does have a sexuality, and she does have, you know, she reacts positively to his, you know, basically flirting with her. Like, but what you were saying earlier about, oh, like that's just him being a moody teen. Like that's one kind of quality that this film has that I like, is, you know, where does the mental illness stop, and where, you know, where does the personality begin? Mm-hmm. Like it's not always a clear distinction, just the way it's not in life. You know, you talk about curing a mental illness, but sometimes it's like, how do you cure a person? Like that's just who that person is. And you know, to what extent can you say that's a product of this mental illness, or to what extent is that just their personality? Like I feel like the film integrates that with the characters in a way that feels really believable.
Maybe I shouldn't have to have moody teen more. He doesn't know how to handle his mental illness.
Well, his way of trying to cope with it is by keeping a lot of distance from people, and like that just sort of exacerbates it. You know, what ultimately helps his breakthrough is by actually making connections and sort of reaching out, not closing himself off. Like he seems so cold in those opening scenes. He's very intense. He's very
closed off. This is a bad comparison, but he reminds me of Sheldon from Big Bang Theory. A little bit.
Maybe. That character, it's supposed to also have mental illness, right?
Oh, yeah,
watch the show, but
it's something like that.
Well, I was thinking it's not a surprise why he would end up starring in a Kubrick film, because he has that really intense, focused quality to him that you see sometimes in these Kubrick characters. Like, that's like, you know, that shot where it's sort of zooming out, like that feels like, oh, like you could just plop that shot in a Kubrick film and it would make sense, you know, like of course he's got to star.
Oh, you mean movies. The dinner shot of him between the candles?
That looks like something out of Barry Lyndon.
Oh, yeah. Right?
Like that's not just me thinking. Oh,
that totally has like that. I don't know when Kubrick started doing that, but Kubrick would always have that staring shot of that's very symmetrical with different things happening on different sides of the screen.
Like that's in The Shining, that's in Barry Lyndon, that's in Clockwork Orange. Like that's the opening shot of Clockwork Orange.
There are two in Clockwork Orange. There's one in the beginning and one towards the end.
So I don't, maybe it's because of this film, like Kubrick, where he picked that up from. I don't know.
Who
Because,
knows?
I mean, he obviously saw it, I
Yeah,
think.
I haven't seen his Hollywood era stuff, so I really don't know.
Oh, I should mention the actor who plays Dr. Swinford, Howard Da Silva, he was blacklisted, so that's how he ended up in the film, because they could get him cheap because nobody wanted to work with him. But he was a pretty big name. Like, he was in tons of films, and eventually he kind of made a comeback. Like, I know he's in 1776, the film, you know,
Oh,
that's
that musical, that's like 4 hours long.
How long is that movie?
It's I think it's over 3 hours, which it's too long for me to sit through. I know that.
Okay. Right. But, like, you know, he was in a lot of films in the, like, 30s, 40s, 50s, and then,
Oh,
Blacklist came along
he's
and
in
he
Mommy Dearest.
Right. He's in Mommy Dearest. He was in something else. I remember I was like, oh, he's
Oh,
that guy,
he's in
but.
Great Gatsby. I saw that in high school in class because we hadn't enough time to finish the book, the 70s one.
Oh, he's in the
Yeah,
70s
with
one?
Sam
Okay.
Waterston. And my teacher picked it
Right.
because she loves Sam Waterston.
I got to admit, I like the Baz Luhrmann
I skipped it because I hate that book.
one.
So, we're basically at the end, so I want to have the listeners know this. Frank Perry and Eleanor Perry are the aunt and uncle of Katy Perry, the pop singer.
Right. I did a podcast on The Swimmer for Wrong Reel, and I forgot to mention the trivia, and I was just like kicking myself because that's like the one thing people would, I don't know, know or care about now, it
Yeah.
feels like. But yeah, they're
Yeah,
related,
she
so.
comes from Hollywood royalty, question mark?
I don't know if the Perrys were ever royalty because they were always associated with these like indie films
Yeah.
and stuff. I don't
I don't know.
know what you call it.
They
It's
were
like.
always around. People knew who they were. But
Right.
I don't know. Yeah, so maybe that name helped get her pop career going. Who knows? But Frank died in the 90s.
Right.
So I don't really know.
It's too bad, like the filmography seems so muddled.
And some stuff is just hard to track down.
David and Lisa was hard to get a hold of. Like, I'd seen it on TV a couple years ago, and then just recently they put out the Blu-ray. And like, I think the company that did the Blu-ray, it's Scorpion Releasing,
Yeah.
who usually does like more like exploitation films
Yeah.
kind of stuff, which I don't know. Like, it seems like a
That's
weird
what I have. Yeah, that's
pick,
for
and
one I have.
yeah.
And special features are not great. I was kind of like, oh, I'm kind of spoiled by Vinegar Syndrome and Arrow.
Right. Well, and The Swimmer also, like, I think it was put out by, I think it was maybe Cult.
Cool
Or
Epics.
no, not Cult Epics, Grindhouse
Oh.
Releasing. You know, and like they put out like Cannibal Ferox and The Beyond and Cat in the Brain. So like it was weird for them to put out this like Burt Lancaster drama from the 60s. Like, it just seems like, I don't know,
Frank
like
Perry
they're not
feel.
quite cult films, the Frank Perry movies, but like they're maybe a little bit too niche, I think, for a lot of
I don't
people, I
know. Frank
guess.
Perry
I don't
feels
know.
like Aero Academy. Because Aero Academy does like Seijun Suzuki, Te Chau trilogy. They did The Apartment recently.
Totally. But I don't, because like I think the film sort of disappeared in people's minds when they weren't easy to get a hold of. Partly, I guess, because they were independent films, like they weren't readily available. And now that they're back on home video and Blu-ray and look all nice, maybe people can rediscover them. I don't
Yeah.
know,
I don't
but.
know if David and Lisa is still on Fandor, but it was for a little bit.
Right. So I don't know if there's anything you didn't get a chance to mention that you would like to, or if we covered most of it.
No, we got it.
Okay. Mostly I just like Cure Delay's delivery of I Detest Bowling. So thank you, Spencer, for coming on the show,
Oh,
and
you're welcome.
if folks want to find you on the internet, where can they look?
They can hear me on High and Low, a Curse Off podcast, which you are on discussing your all-time favorite Curse Off movie.
You're being
Yes, I
sarcastic,
am.
but
For Dodeskaden, his Curse Off was first color feature, the first one without Toshirô, his kind of awkward return to film after 5 years of nothing happening.
I had a lot of fun on that episode, even though it's my least favorite Kurosawa film. It was fun to
Yeah,
discuss.
it's a good episode, and you'll be back for Tampopo, I think.
I think so. I got that marked. somewhere,
Oh,
but
and I have a blog, Jailhouse 701,
right.
Japanese Cult Cinema. I just finished a series on going through this random Sonny Chiba movies because it's Sonny Chiba and he made some really fun action movies and some not so great ones either. And now
Right.
I am going through kind of like what you did with Alexei German, going through the every decade of Hideo Gosha's career, starting with Three Outlaw Samurai, which is kind of a Yojimbo ripoff in some aspects, like the ending especially, which is just the beginning of Yojimbo. And ending with his final film, so I'm not picking two films from each decade he worked, talking about his life, the movies, how he grew as an artist, because I noticed no one cares about Gosha. People care about Suzuki and like Imamura and Oshima, but no one seems to care about Gosha, so.
No, there's not that much out there. And like even like I know the Criterion DVD for Three Outlaw Samurai is pretty bare bones, so that's really cool that you're gonna dig up some interesting information and put it out there for people. So I'm looking forward to
Yeah, well,
that.
hopefully. It's gonna take a while. I've never done anything like this before. Maybe I'll start a Gosha wave. Who knows, but.
Gosha Wave sounds like an awesome genre of like synth pop.
Yeah, it does, kinda.
And if folks want to follow the show, the Twitter's at FlixWise. I'm at Movie Kessler on Twitter. The website's FlixWise.com. We're also on Facebook. And until next time, listeners, take care. Thank you.
Bye.
Goodbye.